Welcome to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine's Fiction Podcast. I'm Janet Hutchings, Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine's editor. This episode in our podcast series is being recorded on site at the Baoshikan World Mystery Convention in Indianapolis, Indiana. With me are three authors whose stories frequently appear in EQMM, Michael Z. Lewin, Peter Lovesey, and Liza Cody. They are all, individually, highly esteemed as novelists and short story writers, but they have also often collaborated with each other on projects such as teaching and public appearances. A few years ago, they came up with an idea for a completely different sort of collaboration, and EQMM published the results in our March-April 2007 issue. Liza, can you tell us something about that project and what inspired it?
Well, the notion that we often have about where we get our ideas from, which seems to be a very nebulous question to answer, and we suddenly thought, well, what would happen if we all got the same idea at the same time? And what would happen then? Would we all do the same kind of story, or would we do something completely different?
It's a question that we're often asked when we're out in public by readers. We don't really know quite what the answer is. Ideas just come, but we thought, okay, let's have an idea. Let's sit down and have an idea and see what happens.
And the most obvious way, really, we talked about it, was to use one particular sort of form of stimulus. And we thought about reading newspapers and seeing if we could find anything in the papers that would inspire all three of us.
We quite often send things that we see in print to each other, but it was best in this case if we got one that wasn't scurrilous and could itself be reproduced.
And then we found this strange little story about German bank robbers who were sort of way past the age of consent and who got caught simply because they were old. Wasn't that it?
Yes, it appealed to us immediately. But
seeing as how we're so young and agile ourselves.
Exactly.
I think you should read the article, Peter.
Right.
All those in favor?
Mm. Aye.
Where did you find the article, Peter?
It was in a magazine called The Week. And it's about a German group, as Liza mentioned. Hagen, Germany. Pensioner gang on trial. Three geriatric criminals have gone on trial accused of carrying out a string of armed robberies across western Germany. Rudi Richter, 74, Wilfried Ackermann, 73, and Lotte Ackermann, 64, have admitted taking part in 14 robberies that earned them a total of 1.3 million euros. They began robbing banks in 1988, but were forced to stop the next year when Wilfried was arrested and sent to prison for 10 years. In 2000, they reformed and reached their peak 3 years later, scooping a quarter of a million euros in five heists. Age, however, eventually caught up with them. Rudy couldn't really get up the stairs anymore, and we constantly had to stop so that he could go to the toilet, said Wilfried. At first, police assumed they were looking for young men. They realised their mistake when a witness reported hearing the thieves wheezing.
I don't think we could ever write anything better than the original.
It's perfect, isn't it?
Yeah, but we try.
Well, I have to disagree with you there. I think all three of you spun terrific stories off that common idea. Let's hear one of them now.
Say that again, Peter Lovesey. We called him the Brigadier with a Buggered Ear. Just looking at it made you wince. Really, he should have had the bits surgically removed. He claimed it was an old war wound. However, Sadie the Lady, another of our residents, told us it wasn't true. She said she'd talked to the Brig's son, Arnold, who reckoned his old man got blind drunk in Aldershot one night and tripped over a police dog and paid for it with his shell-like. Because of his handicap, the brigadier tended to shout. His good ear wasn't up to much, even with the aid stuck in it. We got used to the shouting, we old farts, in the never-say-die retirement home. After all, most of us are hard of hearing as well. No doubt we were guilty of letting him bluster and bellow without interruption. We never dreamed at the time that our compliance would get us into the High Court on a murder rap. It was set in motion by She Who Must Be Replaced, our so-called matron, pinning a new leaflet on the notice board in the hall. "Infernal cheek," the brig boomed. "They're parasites, these people, living off the frail and weak-minded." "Who are you calling weak-minded?" Sadie the lady piped up. "There's nothing wrong with my brain." The brig didn't hear. Sometimes it can be a blessing. "Listen to this," he bellowed, as if we had any choice. "Are you dissatisfied with your hearing? Struggling with a faulty instrument? Picking up unwanted background noise?" Marcus Halliburton, a renowned expert on the amazing new digital hearing aids, will be in attendance all day at the Bay Tree Hotel on Thursday the 8th of April for free consultations. Call this number now for an appointment. No obligation. No obligation, my ass. Forgive me, ladies. You know what happens? They get you in there and tell you to take out your national health aid so they can poke one of those little torches in your ear, and of course, you're stuffed. You can't hear a thing they're saying from that moment on. The next thing is they shove a form in front of you and you find you've signed an order for a £1,000 replacement. If you object, they drop your NHS aid on the floor and tread on it.
That can't be correct, Miss Martindale said.
Completely wrecked, yes, the bigger said. Are you speaking from personal experience, my dear? Because I am. Someone put up a hand. He wanted to be helped to the toilet, but the brigadier took it as support. Good man! What we should do is teach these blighters a lesson. We could, you know, with my officer training and George's underworld experience. I smiled faintly. My underworld links were nil, another of the brig's misunderstandings. One afternoon I'd been talking to Sadie about cats, and happened to mention that we once adopted a stray. I thought the brig was dozing in his armchair, but he came to life and said, "Which of the crays was that, Reggie or Ronnie? I had no idea of your criminal past, George. We'll have to watch you in future." It was hopeless trying to disillusion him, so I settled for my gangster reputation, and some of the old ladies began to believe it too, and found me more interesting than ever they'd supposed. By the next tea break, the brigadier had turned puce with excitement. "I've mapped it out," he told us. "I'm calling it Operation Syringe, because we're going to clean these ruffians out. Basically, the object of the plan is to get a new super-digital hearing aid for everyone in this house, free of charge."
"How the heck will you do that?" Sadie asked.
"What?"
She stepped closer and spoke into his ear. "They're a private company. Those aids cost a fortune."
The brig grinned. "Simple. We intercept their supplies. I happen to know the Bay Tree Hotel quite well."
Sadie said to the rest of us, "That's a fact. The Legion has its meetings there. He's round there every Friday night for his G&T.
G&T or two or three, another old lady said. I said, "Wait a minute, Brigadier, we can't steal a bunch of hearing aids."
I have a carrying voice when necessary, and he heard every word.
"Steal is not a term in the military lexicon, dear boy," he said. "We requisition them."
He leaned forward.
"Now the operation has three phases. Number one, observation. I'll take care of that. Number two, liaison. This means getting in touch with an inside man, Cormac the barman. I can do that also. Number three, action. And that depends on what we learn from phases one and two. That's where the rest of you come in. Are you with me?"
"I don't know what he's on about," Sadie said to me. "Don't worry," I said. "He's playing soldiers, that's all. He'll find out it's a non-starter."
"No muttering in the ranks," the brigadier said. "Any dissenters? Fall out the dissenters."
No one moved. Some of us needed help to move anywhere, and nobody left the room when tea and biscuits were on offer. And that was how we were recruited into the Snap Squad. On Saturday, the brigadier reported on phases one and two of his battle plan. He marched into the tea room looking as chipper as Montgomery on the eve of El Alamein.
"Well, the obo phase is over, and so is the liaison, and I'm able to report some fascinating results. The gentleman who wants us all to troop along to the Bay Tree Hotel and buy his miraculous hearing aids
is clearly doing rather well out of it. He drives a vintage Bentley and wears a different suit each visit, and by the cut of them, they're not off the peg.
There's money in ripping off old people, Sadie said.
It ought to be stopped, her friend Bryony said. The brig went on. I talked to my contact last night, and I'm pleased to tell you that the enemy, that is to say, Marcus Halliburton, works to a predictable routine. He puts in a fortnightly appearance at the Bay Tree. If you go along and see him, you'll find Session 1 is devoted to the consultation and the placing of the order. Session 2 is the fitting and payment. Between Sessions 1 and 2, a box is delivered to the hotel, and it contains up to 50 new hearing aids. More than enough for our needs. He paused and looked around the room. So, what do you think is the plan? No one was willing to say. Some might have thought speaking up would incriminate them. Others weren't capable of being heard by the brigadier. Finally, I said, We requisition the box. Ha! He lifted a finger. I thought you'd say that. We can do better. What we do is requisition the box. There were smiles all round at my expense. And then, the brigadier said, we replace the box with one just like it. That's neat, Sadie said. She was beginning to warm to the brigadier's criminal scheme. He misheard her again. It may sound like deceit to you, madam, but to some of us it's common justice. They called Robin Hood a thief. Are we going to be issued with bows and arrows, Sadie said.
I wouldn't mind meeting some merry men, Bryony said.
The brigadier's next move took us all by surprise.
Check the corridor, George. Make sure no staff are about.
I did as I was told and gave the thumb-up sign, whereupon the old boy bent down behind the sideboard and dragged out a flattened cardboard box that he rapidly restored to its normal shape.
Thanks to my contacts at the hotel, I've managed to retrieve the box that was used to deliver this week's aids.
No question he intended to go through with this crazy adventure. In the best officer tradition, he started to delegate duties.
George, your job will be to get this packed and sealed and looking as if it just arrived by courier.
No problem, I said, to indulge him. I was sure the plan would break down before I had to do anything.
That isn't so simple as it sounds, he said. Take a close look. The aids are made in South Africa. So there are various customs forms attached to the box. They stuff them in a kind of envelope and stick them to the outside. What you do is update this week's documents.
See what I can manage.
Then you must consider the contents. The instruments don't weigh much, and they're wrapped in bubble wrap, so the whole thing is almost as light as air. Whatever you put inside must not arouse suspicion.
A crumpled up newspaper, Sadie said.
What did she say?
I repeated it for his benefit. Sadie said, Bryony has a stack of Daily Mails this high in her room. She hoards everything. I knew that to be true. Bryony kept every postcard, every letter, every magazine. Her room was a treasure house of things other people discarded. She even collected the tiny jars our breakfast marmalade came in. The only question was whether she would donate her newspaper collection to Operation Syringe. She could be fiercely possessive at times.
I might be able to spare you some of the leaflets that come with my post, she said.
Sadie said, junk mail, that'll do.
It doesn't incriminate me, does it? She said. I want no part of this silly escapade.
Excellent, the brigadier said, oblivious. When the parcel is up to inspection standard, I'll tell you about the next phase.
The heat was now on. I had to smuggle the box back to my room and start work.
I was once employed as a graphic designer, so the forging of the forms wasn't a big problem. Getting Bryony to part with her junk mail was far more demanding. You'd think it was banknotes. She checked everything and allowed me about one sheet in five. But in the end, I had enough to stuff the box. I sealed it with packing tape I found in Matron's office and showed it to the brigadier.
Capital, he said. We can proceed to phase four, distracting the enemy.
How do we do that?
We inundate Marcus Halliburton with requests for appointments under bogus names.
That's fun, I'll tell the others. Even at this stage it was still a game, as I tried to explain later to the police. Some of us had mobiles and others used the payphone by the front door. I think a couple of bold souls used the phone in Matron's office. I don't know if we succeeded in distracting Halliburton. He must have been surprised by the number of Smiths, Browns, Jones and Robinsons who had seen his publicity. The greedy beggar didn't turn any away. And so the day of the heist arrived. Almost everyone from the Never Say Die had been talked into joining in and clambered onto the bus the Brigadier had laid on. Half of them were so confused most of the time that you could have talked them into running the London Marathon. The notable exception was Bryony. She wanted no part of it. She stayed put, guarding her hoard of newspapers and marmalade jars. The Brigadier called her a ruddy conchy when he found out. In their defence, few of them knew the finer points of the battle plan, but they still amounted to a formidable squad as they alighted from the bus and listened to the Brigadier's Agincourt-style speech. There are senior citizens all over Britain who will think themselves a curse they were not here with us. We few, we happy few, deaf but not downtrodden, stand on the brink of victory. Onward then! So began the main assault, as the Brigadier called it. Four old ladies crossed the hotel foyer, zimmer to zimmer, a vanguard forging a route for the main party. 12 more on sticks and crutches, with 2 motorized chairs like tanks in the rear. Inexorably they headed for the suite used by Marcus Halliburton for his consultations. Their task, to block all movement in the corridor. Because of my supposed underworld connections, I had been selected for a kind of SAS role, along with the Brigadier himself. At some time in the first hour, while all the new patients were being documented, tested and examined, a security firm would deliver the latest box of hearing aids to the hotel. One of the staff was then supposed to bring it to the suite for Halliburton to begin handing out the aids to people who had placed orders on his previous visit. Thanks to the congestion in the corridor, this would not be possible. The next part was clever, I must admit. The Brigadier had booked the room 2 doors up, and he and I were waiting in there with our own box filled up with crumpled up junk mail. The porter was bound to come past with the box containing the expensive digital aids. We waited 3/4 of an hour, and it was a nervous time. I had my doubts whether 2 elderly gents were capable of intercepting a burly hotel porter, but the Brigadier was confident. "We're not using brute strength. This is our strength." He tapped his head. "But if it doesn't work?" To my horror, he took a gun from his pocket and gave a crocodile grin. "My old service revolver." "That would be armed robbery," I said, aghast. "Don't even think of it." He misheard me, of course. From another pocket, he produced a flask of brandy. "You need to drink a bit. Take a swig, old boy. It stops the shakes, I find." Before I could get through to him, I heard the squeak of a trolley wheel in the corridor outside. The moment of decision. Should I abort the whole operation? Unwisely, disastrously as it turned out, I decided to go on with it. I stepped into the corridor, right in the path of the trolley, and said to the porter pushing it, "Mr. Halliburton said to lock the parcel in here for the time being. He'll collect it when the people waiting have been dealt with." He said, "I can't do that. I'm under firm instructions to hand it to Mr. Halliburton in person." I winked and said, "I work with him. It's as good as done." I pressed a 5-pound note into his sweaty palm. Persuaded, he wheeled the parcel into the room and left it just inside the door. The Brigadier, meanwhile, had stepped out of sight into the bathroom. The porter had the impression he was locking the parcel in an empty room. The idea was that the Brigadier would then emerge from the bathroom with our box of junk mail and make the switch, returning to the bathroom with the box containing the aids, where he would lock himself in for an hour. My job was to shepherd the Never Say Die residents as quickly as possible out of the corridor and back to the bus. I was starting to do so when a man in a grey pinstripe suit came marching up and said, "What's the trouble here? I'm Buckfield, the hotel manager." "No trouble, Mr. Buckfield," I said. "The system can't cope, that's all. Some of these old people have been waiting an hour for an appointment with the ear specialist. I'm suggesting they come back next time. We've got transport outside." He looked at me with some uncertainty. "Are you their warden?" Something like that. "One of the bellboys tells me he delivered a box of valuable hearing aids to room 104. Was that at your bidding?" I said, yes, I think you'll find it's still there. He had a pass key and opened the door and picked up the parcel that was waiting there. I gave all my attention to ushering the old ladies towards the foyer and the waiting bus. Most of them were pleased to leave and didn't understand what we had achieved. A few genuine customers for the hearing aids were just as confused. When we got to the bus, I had difficulty persuading two of them that they weren't in the Never Say Die party. Finally, everyone except the Brigadier was on board. It was my job to see that all was clear and help him out of room 104 with the parcel we had requisitioned, the most dangerous part of Operation Syringe. Trying to look like any other guest, I crossed the foyer and stepped along the corridor. It was now empty of people. I tapped on the door of 104 and immediately realized that there was a fatal flaw in our plan. How would the Brigadier hear my knocking? I tried a second time. No response. Along the corridor, the door of Halliburton's suite opened and an old man came out. I tried to ignore him, but he said,
Are you waiting for a consultation? It's that room I just came out of.
I thanked him, but I don't think he heard. I took off a shoe and tried hammering on 104 with it. At last the door opened, and there was the Brigadier with the parcel in his arms. For the first time since I'd known him, he looked concerned.
Take this to the bus and tell the driver to put his foot down.
Aren't you coming? I said.
Cunning? Far from it, he said. I'm a silly ass. Left my service revolver on the bed, and some beggar in a pinstripe picked it up.
Leave it, I shouted into his ear. Come with me.
Can't do that, he said, and made a little speech straight out of one of those war films when the doomed Brit showed his stiff upper lip. That revolver is my baby. Been with me all over the world. I am not surrendering, old boy. I'll get back to base. See if I don't.
I said, I'm leaving with a heavy heart.
He said, don't be so vulgar.
No use trying to talk sense into him. He really had need of a decent hearing aid. I carried the parcel to the bus. Everyone cheered when they saw it. Then Sadie said, where's the Brigadier? I didn't want them to know he'd brought a gun with him, so I said he was hiding up until it was safer to leave. The bus took us back to the home, and we tottered off to our rooms for a nap after all the excitement. We'd agreed not to open the box before the brig returned. All evening we waited, asking each other if anyone had heard anything. I was up until 10:30, long past bedtime. In the end, I turned in and tried to sleep. Sometime after midnight, there was a noise like a stone being thrown at my window. I got out of bed and looked down. There in the grounds was the Brigadier, blowing on his fingers. He shouted up to me,
"Be a good fellow and unbolt the front door, will you? I just met a brass monkey on his way to the welders."
In 20 minutes, every inhabitant of the house, except the matron and her two night staff, assembled in the tea room. The nightwear on display is another story.
"Open it, George," the brig ordered.
They watched in eager anticipation. Even Bryony had turned out.
"Ooh, bubble wrap," she said. "May I have that?"
"You might as well, because you're not getting a hearing aid, you conchy," the Brigadier said.
I unwrapped the first aid. It was a BTE, a behind the ear, but elegance itself. I offered it to the Brigadier. He slotted it into his ear.
"Good Lord," he said. "I can hear the clock ticking."
Everyone in the room who wanted a replacement aid was given one, and we still had a few over. The morale of the troops couldn't have been higher. Even Bryony was happy with her stack of bubble wrap. We all slept well. At breakfast, the results were amazing. People who hadn't conversed for years were chatting animatedly. Then the doorbell chimed. The chime of doom. A policeman with a megaphone stood in the doorway and announced,
"Police! We're coming in! Put your hands above your heads and stay where you are!"
Sadie said, "You don't have to shout, young man. We can all hear you." We were taken in barred vans to the police station and kept in cells. Because there was a shortage of cells, some of us had to double up, and I found myself locked up with the Brigadier. "This is overkill," I said. "We're harmless old people."
"They don't think so, George," he said.
in a sombre tone. Marcus Halliburton was shot dead in the course of the raid.
Shot? I didn't hear any shots.
After you left, it got nasty. They'll have me for murder, and the rest of you for conspiracy to murder. We can't expect all our troops to hold out under questioning. They'll put up their hands, and we're all done.
He was right. Several old ladies confessed straight away. What can you expect?
The trial that followed was swift and savage. The brigadier asked to be tried by a court-martial and refused to plead. He went down for life, with a recommendation that he serve at least 10 years. They proved that the fatal shots had been fired from his gun. I got 3 years for conspiracy to murder, in spite of claiming I didn't know about the gun. Sadie was given 6 months. The Crown Prosecution Service didn't press charges against some of the really frail ones. Oddly, nobody seemed interested in the hearing aid heist, and we were allowed to keep our stolen property. The Never Say Die retirement home had to carry on without us. But there was to be one last squirt from Operation Syringe. One morning, 3 weeks after the trial, Bryony decided to sort out her marmalade jars and store them better, using the bubble wrap the aides had been kept in. She was surrounding one of the jars with the stuff when there was a sudden popping sound. One of the little bubbles had burst under pressure. She pressed another, and it made a satisfying sound. Highly amused, she started popping every one. She continued at this harmless pastime for over an hour. After tea break, she went back and popped some more. It was all enormous fun until she damaged her fingernail and had to ask she who must be replaced to trim it.
"How did you do that?"
Matron asked. Bryony showed her.
"Well, no wonder. There's something hard inside the bubble. I do believe it's glass. How wicked!"
But it didn't turn out to be glass. It was an uncut diamond, and there were others secreted in the bubble wrap. A second police investigation was mounted into Operation Syringe. As a result, Buckfield, the manager of the Bay Tree Hotel, was arrested. It seemed he had been working a racket with Marcus Halliburton, importing uncut diamonds stolen by workers in a South African diamond mine. The little rocks had been smuggled to Britain in the packing used for the hearing aids. Interpol took over the investigation on two continents. It turned out that on the day of our heist, Buckfield, the manager, suspected something was afoot and decided Halliburton might be double-crossing him. When he checked room 104, he found the brigadier's revolver on the bed, and he was certain he was right. He took it straight to the suite. Halliburton denied everything and said he was only a go-between and offered to open the new box of aids in the manager's presence. We know what it contained. Incensed, Buckfield pointed the gun and shot Halliburton dead. After our release, we had a meeting to decide if we would sue the police for wrongful imprisonment. The brigadier was all for it, but Sadie said we might be pushing our luck. We had a vote and decided she was right. The good thing is that every one of us heard each word of the debate. I can recommend these new digital aids to anyone.
Peter Lovesy reading his story Say That Again. And now here's Liza Cody with her short story contribution to the project.
The Old Story, Liza Cody. It was a sharp, clear autumn day, and as afternoon turned to evening, Harold and I met, by appointment, outside Quicksave. No sooner had we met than I had my first shock. "Move your wrinkly bum holes," a kid yelled at us. And I moved, sharpish, pulling Harold with me. I was amazed at the kids' good manners. Normally, they skate right through us without warning, like we're fallen leaves scattering in a high wind. Harold took a swipe with the wrong end of his cane, trying to hook the board's back wheels. Three things about Harold. One, he's hot-headed. Two, he won't admit he's as deaf as a bathroom door. And I've forgotten number three. The boy whooshed away unharmed and unaware he hadn't even come close to being upended.
He zigged and swerved and zagged and curved along the pavement, scaring oldies, youngies and in-betweenies. Harold said, "Spotty little turd," and banged his cane on the ground. "He doesn't know how close he came." Harold mimed the murder of a spotty little turd. "I could have done for him. He doesn't know who he's messing with." "Let's keep it that way," I said, taking Harold's arm. "Huh?" said Harold, and I gave his elbow a pacifying pat. Sometimes I think I'm only included on this enterprise to pacify hot-headed Harold, because clearly it has been many, many years since I heated anybody's head, and therefore my two old friends, the Gent and Wiggy, gave me the job of keeping him manageable. He boasts that when he was young, he ran with one of those famous South London gangs, but neither Wiggy nor the Gent believe him. I'm uncertain. We don't usually work with outsiders. I kept walking and wondering why the three of us had fallen for Harold's pitch. It isn't as if he's charming and clever like the Gent, or clever and funny like Wiggy, and it wasn't as if it were a particularly good plan. In fact, it was downright crude when you consider the slickness of our usual operations. But when I say usual, I have to admit that nowadays we don't plan much, and the last operation was Wiggy's, for nasal polyps. Speaking entirely for myself, I wonder if my reluctance is due to the technicalities of modern banks and building societies. All the intelligent work is done with computers. Modern operators who want to rob a bank only have to flip a switch and rattle around on a keyboard. They don't even need to visit the premises anymore. As Wiggy said, you can rob without even leaving your own home. All you want is your own five-finger girlfriend. And a little more know-how than we possess, confessed the Gent. I kept my mouth shut. Technical stuff confuses me, and I don't even own a computer. My contributions to our joint enterprises used mainly to be in the planning stage, and as a distraction when the operation went live. I could scream or faint or suffer epifits better than any RADA-trained actress. Elsie's scream is world-famous, the Gent used to say. But it hasn't been employed for nearly 5 years, and my skill in planning is thwarted by security and surveillance I no longer understand. Which explains why, on a sharp, clear autumn evening, I was calming Harold and walking as fast as his hip would take us towards Preston's betting shop at the corner of Grosvenor Road and High Street. My hand was firmly in the crook of Harold's elbow. Our reflection in the coffee shop window showed me that we looked frighteningly like an old married couple. We should be retired and living by the seaside, I thought. But how do you retire from a business like ours? There isn't a company pension. Besides, the Gent is having to remortgage his house because his son's in debt again, as is my daughter, but I try not to think about it. And early this month, Wiggy was released from his last vacation at Her Majesty's pleasure to find that his precious Airstream had been repossessed by the finance company. During his absence, his sister, who should have been dealing with the payments, took a dippy turn and handed all his money to a donkey sanctuary. So often in our insecure lives, the three of us have found ourselves starting from scratch. We are all, in our separate ways, dogged by the choices we made when we were young and thought we would always be ahead of the game. My recollections were interrupted by someone calling, "Mrs. Ivo! Hey, Mrs. Ivo!" I would have walked on, but Wiggy appeared from the Bell Pub doorway and said, "Oh, bloody hell, she's forgotten her own code name. Elsie, you'd forget your family if you didn't carry photos." "You pronounced it wrong," I said stiffly. "It's Evo. You said Ivo." "Evo, Ivo. Nevo, Nivo. Let's call the whole thing off." "Eh?" said Harold. "No one's calling nothing off." "It's just one of Wiggy's jokes," I said, patting his arm. "What are you doing here?" I asked Wiggy. "We're supposed not to meet until..." "Come inside," Wiggy said, looking past my shoulder. "Hurry. The CCTV camera's swinging in our direction." "Huh?" said Harold. Wiggy took one arm, I tugged the other, and we whisked him into the pub before he became visible and bellicose. "We've run into a problem," Wiggy explained, pointing to the slumped figure of the Gent at a table in a dark corner of the barroom. "I'll have a pint since you're offering," Harold said. "One won't hurt." I hurried over to the gent. "Itch my tooth," he said, covering the lower part of his face with his hand. "Not his wisdom tooth, obviously," Wiggy said. "He was supposed to go to the dentist last week, but he funked it." "I don't think I can do the job," the gent said, and indeed he looked yellowish and extremely unwell. "Oil of cloves," I said, rummaging in my handbag. "Now's not the time for your portable pharmacopoeia," Wiggy said. "He's already rattling the number of pills he's necked since lunch." "I don't want to hold you back," moaned the gent. "I really am so sorry." "What's wrong with him?" Harold sat down heavily, slopping his pint. "Tooth rot." "Huh?" "Forget it," Wiggy said. "The only way I can see out of this is if the gent waits in the car and does the driving instead of Elsie. Elsie is lookout instead of Harold, and Harold comes up to the betting shop with me instead of the gent." "Huh? Say again?" "The gent waits in the car." "Shut up," I said. "Anyone could hear you, except Harold." "So what's going on?" "And that's another thing about Harold. Even before his hearing failed, he never listened." "Are you quite sure you want Harold on stage with you at showtime?" The gent was speaking through considerable pain. "Huh? Do we have any alternative, or should we just abort?" I would have pressed for standing us all down. It's what any sensible woman would have done. But I didn't want to spend the rest of my life eating lunch at the YMCA cafeteria. I'd rather go back to Chokey, I thought. At least there, bad food comes free. Because when times were good, Wiggy, the gent, and I often lived high in the sky in foreign cities, where hotel suites were more spacious than English houses. Rhubarb and custard at the YMCA isn't the worst thing life can throw at you. But if I thought it was all I've had to offer from here on in, I think I'd want to top myself. As it turned out, I went on stage with Wiggy. The gent waited in the car, and Harold kept his job as lookout. It wasn't possible to explain a change of plan to him without a bullhorn, and shouting your plans through a bullhorn when you're making changes to a heist on a betting shop is not advisable. "Take my coat," the gent said. "The mask is in the left pocket, and the plastic gun is in the other." Wordlessly, I took the coat and gave him my small bottle of oil of cloves in return. Wordlessly, Wiggy handed over the car keys. "Showtime," said the gent with a brave smile. "Sparkle, guys. I know you'll be splendid." We left him in the car park behind Christette's kitchenware and novelties. The great thing about Christette's is that the main door opens onto the high street and you can walk all the way through to the car park at the back. The shop is hugger-mugger with too many shelves and stacks, and there are no surveillance cameras. It's a great place if you want to get off the street in a hurry. Preston's is a small betting shop above a newsagent at the corner of Grosvenor Road and High Street. We reached the newsagent 5 minutes before the betting shop was due to close and left Harold pretending to read the small ads in the early evening paper. He seemed edgy. Halfway up the narrow flight of stairs, Wiggy and I paused to put on our masks and raise the hoods of our coats. It was only then that I realized how much condition Wiggy had lost in his last spell away. For a big man, he was always fit and pretty fast, but now he sounded like a hinge that needed a squirt of oil. "What's up?" I muttered, trying to make the coat of a much taller man zip over a much fuller bosom. "Just an allergy," Wiggy wheezed back. "These stairs haven't been swept." His mask was an elaborate affair that could have graced a Venetian ball. "Decongestant?" "Not now, Elsie," he said patiently, which was just as well as I'd left my bag in the car with the gent. The gent's mask was a simple but elegant thing his wife had knitted especially for him, from a silk and wool mix. I pulled it over my head and topped it with a hood. "Let's get this over with," I said. "The hood's ruining my hair." "Let your coat hang open," Wiggy wheezed. "You still look too much like a woman." "And you look like a real hunk," I snarled back. "Let's go, and leave the talking to me." But after climbing to the top of the stairs, he didn't have enough breath to blow out a birthday candle, and the staff behind the grills didn't even look up as he stood there panting and swinging his baseball bat. So I took over. Everybody freeze, I yelled. Instantly, everyone stopped what they were doing. Oh, the power! No one had taken this much notice of me since my daughter was too small to talk back. The money, I shouted. Give us the money and no one will get hurt. The gun, Wiggy hissed, his chest heaving. It's still in your goddamn pocket. To cover for me, he strode to the counter and whacked the baseball bat against the grill. The man and the woman behind the counter cowered in shock. The manager started towards the back. I fumbled the plastic gun out of my pocket and pointed it at him. Don't move a muscle, I bellowed. Instruct your people to fill our bags, or I'll put two bullets in your fat gut. Believe me, I can't miss. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Wiggy push a bunch of crumpled plastic bags through the grill. They came from Safeway, and I swear they're the same ones we used on our last job. Wiggy never throws anything away. By now, he'd recovered his breath enough to say, Fill the bags, quickly, unless you want to see your boss shot. He sounded eerily like an automaton. The woman started to cry, but she began to stuff bundles of money into the bags. The manager stood feebly protecting his paunch with his hands. I kept the gun trained on him while I screamed at the other younger man, Help her, now! And he suddenly jerked into life and started stuffing bags too. I was jubilant. Energy surged through every cell of my body. I had no idea what a sense of self-worth there was to be gained from pointing a plastic gun. Tie the bags, Wiggy growled, and throw them over the grill. Bags sailed over the grill and dropped at our feet. We'd done it. All we had to do was pick up the bags and leave. Or not. The door at the top of the stair swung open and a man in Secure Corps uniform walked through, humming a tune from Guys and Dolls. Hi there, he said. Cashed up, everyone? Ready to go? Then he saw Wiggy. Then he saw me. Then he heard thunderous crashes from the stairs below. He drew his weapon. The young man behind the counter started to cry loudly. Harold charged through the door. Wiggy swung his baseball bat. I picked up as many bags of cash as I could manage. Harold fired his gun. A huge lump of plaster detached itself from the ceiling and fell on the Secure Corps guard's head just as Wiggy's bat connected. Oh, fucking hell, yelled the Secure Corps guard, who was wearing protective headgear but went down in a pile of rubble anyway. Harold fired his gun at the manager, who seemed to be making for his panic button. The manager went down. I said, that wasn't supposed to happen. Don't just stand there, Wiggy said, grabbing a couple of carrier bags in the hand that wasn't wielding the bat. Huh? Said Harold, and for once I could see what he meant. A real live gun with real live ammo going off twice in a confined space leaves you with real live tinnitus. It had never happened to me before, but then I'd never worked with Harold before. We scrambled for the door. On the stairs, Wiggy remembered to remove his mask. He pulled mine off too, and snatched the plastic gun out of my numb fingers. Harold stumbled after us, picking up his walking stick from where he'd left it at the bottom and unwinding his scarf from around his head. I didn't even want to look at him. Wiggy, the gent, and I had never, in all our long careers, ever used live firearms. No one had ever been hurt except for the odd womp with a baseball bat when persuasion didn't work. Harold was supposed to be the lookout. He was supposed to have warned us about the Secure Corps guard and not charged in afterwards firing a live gun. I wanted to drop everything and run away from all of them. A lifetime of YMCA lunches didn't seem so bad anymore. I tore off the gent's coat and carried it over my arm, hiding some of the Safeway bags. As I'd feared, my hair was a mess. We stepped out into the bright autumnal street, and Wiggy spun around to face Harold. What the fuck did you do that for? He wheezed. Say again, Harold said. Come on, we got to get back to the car. Elsie, give me a hand. My hip's knackered. I'd like to knacker your thick skull, I said. I wanted to leave him, but I couldn't without endangering the rest of us. Why the hell didn't you warn us? Huh? He leant heavily on my arm, and we limped up the high street towards Christette's kitchenware and novelties. We started shouting, "Why the hell didn't you shut up?" I said. "Anyone could hear, except Harold." Harold didn't even hear the police sirens as three police cars raced past us to the betting shop. My heart was staggering and my vision went speckly. I heard the gunshots. I saw the manager tumble all over again. I'm not quite sure what happened then, because the next thing I remember clearly was the gent helping me out of the car next to my block of flats. He carried a large Christette's bag, which he gave to me when we got to my door. "What's that?" I asked, and the gent sighed. Apparently, I'd had a funny turn in Christette's and insisted on buying three baking trays, a set of glass candle holders, and a large wok. He reassured me that I'd paid for them with my own money. He said that the staff in Christette's were very nice to batty old ladies and had thought nothing of it. "I'll make you a cup of tea," he said sympathetically. "No, no, I'm quite all right," I said, wondering what on earth I'd do with another wok. This wasn't the first funny turn I'd had in the last year, and for some very odd reason I always seemed to buy a wok. But I didn't want to tell the gent about it. "How's the tooth?" I asked, to distract him. "Your oil of cloves worked a treat," he said. "I tried it in the car while I was waiting. The tooth's nearly stopped hurting. You're much more use than a pharmacist, Elsie." Which, of course, is why we call him the gent. He lies to make other people feel good. But he did look better. Wiggy'll be along when he's dropped Harold and dealt with the car. He made sure I was sitting comfortably, and then he went away to make the tea. I sat and wrestled with my wayward mind, trying to figure out what had gone wrong. Why had I felt so wonderful with a plastic gun, so dismal with a live one? Had I drawn attention to us in the shop? What would happen now we were guilty of robbery with violence, maybe even murder? But most of all, I wanted to know what went wrong. I didn't find out till Wiggy showed up when the gent and I were on our third pot of tea. He turned on the TV for the local news before dropping like a rock onto my sofa. His face was grey with fatigue. "Harold," he said, "not my favourite person. Big mistake, working with him." The gent poured him a cup of strong tea, and we waited while he recovered his breath. "Where's the money?" he asked first. "Ah, yes," the gent said, "we need to talk about that." He gave me a sidelong glance and then spoke directly to Wiggy. "At the moment, it's in Elsie's laundry hamper. I know she usually keeps it in her chest freezer, but when I looked in there, I found there wasn't enough room. Elsie, do you know you have four woks in your freezer?" "Wiggy, she's got four woks in her freezer." "I know it's where she hides stuff, but why hide four woks?" "It's none of your business what I keep in my freezer," I said. "Why aren't we talking about what went wrong at the betting shop?" "Hold on," Wiggy said, turning up the volume of the TV. "This is about us. Look." What we saw was black and white, grainy footage from a surveillance camera somewhere in the ceiling of the betting shop. We watched fascinated as two shadowy figures entered, and then one of them skipped around like a goat pointing a gun in all directions. "That can't be me," I said. "I don't jump around." The gent and Wiggy said nothing. Jerkily, the two behind the counter began to fill bags. The film froze while the newsreader said, "Witnesses describe being threatened by two men wearing masks. The third member of the gang only made his appearance after the arrival of an employee from the security firm who should have transported the day's taking to a night safe." "Two men," I said. "That's wonderful. We're home free." Again, the gent and Wiggy stayed silent. The film continued with the leisurely entrance of the man from Secure Corps, shortly followed by the muffled figure of Harold. The newsreader said, "As you can see, the footage ends abruptly when the third man shot out the security camera. The manager of the betting shop, who only survived what he describes as certain death by a trained marksman, when he ducked behind the countertop. He said, These men were armed to the teeth and very violent. They terrorised my staff in what was clearly a meticulously planned raid. Police are asking anyone who witnessed three men fleeing from the scene to contact them immediately. Fleeing? Wiggy said, turning off the TV. Harold flees at the speed of a rocking chair. What's up, Elsie?
I thought Harold shot the manager, I sobbed. I thought...
I know, Wiggy said. Have you got a handkerchief, gent? The old broad needs mopping. The gent passed me his handkerchief, politely pretending not to see my streaming eyes and nose. Wiggy said, who knew Harold even had a gun? Maybe he wasn't lying about the South London gang after all. It's unforgivable, the gent said. We made it quite clear to Harold, no real violence. He knows how we work. We have a reputation.
He wasn't supposed to be there, I said, blowing my nose on the gent's immaculate linen. He was supposed to be lookout. But where was he?
Ah, yes, Wiggy said. Don't think I didn't ask him about that, very loudly. Guess what?
What?
He had a beer in the pub, remember? So he's standing outside the newsagent waiting and watching, and, strike me pink, his bladder starts playing up. So the silly old bugger goes to take a leak. On his way back, he sees the secure cord guy disappearing upstairs, and all he can think of to do is to follow him up and shoot him. He was aiming at the man? The gent asked, horrified.
That's what he said. I'm too old for this, I sniffed.
I have to take the blame, the gent said. If I hadn't been too much of a wimp to go to the dentist, we wouldn't have gone to the pub. If Harold hadn't drunk a pint of bitter, his weak bladder wouldn't have been a determining feature of this fiasco. Don't let's talk blame, Wiggy said firmly, because I might have to admit that I'm not fit enough for this kind of life any more. If I hadn't been out of breath, Elsie wouldn't have had to have taken charge, which she's obviously unsuited to do. I feel directly responsible for her, whatchamacallit.
What?
Don't get arsy with me, Elsie. You had an emotional episode in Christette's. Just a momentary confusion, the gent put in tactfully. You were splendid in the betting shop.
Thanks, I said, but Wiggy's right. I've been having, well, memory lapses. I'm taking St. John's wort and fish oils and something else I can't remember, but I should have told you.
Told us what? Wiggy said. That you're a mad old bat? Gee, what a surprise.
All three of us should think again about the active approach, the gent said. Maybe the way to go is technological.
I haven't got a computer, I said, and it's too late for me to learn, and anyway, I can't afford it.
Yes, you can, the gent said. Besides what we took from the betting shop, you've got... He turned to Wiggy. In her freezer, she's got dozens of oddly shaped packages labelled leg of lamb and ham hock, which, believe me, are not legs of lamb or hocks of ham, or even sides of beef.
You're mistaken, I said. I'm a vegetarian. I don't buy ham hocks.
We know, the gent said. You've got a freezer full of cash under all those woks. You're like a squirrel who's forgotten where she hides her nuts.
She's certainly nuts, Wiggy said, but she might be right.
Gent, we might be home free. No one saw us.
Of course they saw us. I waved at the TV. They called me a man.
Exactly, said the gent. They called two doddery old men and one dotty old lady three very violent men. Longevity makes us invisible, and prejudice renders us incapable.
Apart from ripping off a betting shop, Wiggy said, our second most serious crime was to get old.
But it saved our asses, I said.
Maybe, the gent said, but not for long.
Don't worry, Wiggy consoled me. He doesn't mean the cops. He means the Grim Reaper.
Oh, that's all right then, I said.
Last but certainly not least in our trio of stories is this reading by Michael Z. Lewin of the story that newspaper article about elderly robbers inspired him to write.
Wheeze by Michael Z. Lewin. Georgina Bladen was upstairs ironing. Usually she ironed downstairs when she had the house to herself in front of the big television, but today there was a chance, just a chance, that Barry would stop home after lunch before he headed for Fraserton. His meeting with Jim Pinney was important, and Barry liked to look right when a meeting was important. Mind you, it depended on how long he spent lunching at Maxie's. As well as looking right, Barry also liked to feel good about himself before a meeting, and Maxie's flattery would do that trick. Georgina had long since given up worrying about whether Barry was having a thing with Maxie. In a town the size of Roseville, surely someone would have seen them and shared the observation. And knowing the way Barry thought and operated, Georgina would only begin to worry if he stopped lunching at Maxie's little cafe, dirty as the place was. Georgina sighed. With Barry's shirts done, she thought about taking a break before going on to his vests and boxers. Maybe a cup of the chamomile tea that Floella brought back from her last trip out of state would be calming. Not that Georgina felt she needed calming, but it was good to experience new things. She could make the tea and then call Flo to report how she liked it. Yes, that would work. Downstairs making tea, she could easily hear if Barry's car did pull in. She could be upstairs again before he got into the house. Not as fast as he used to be, Barry. Not that he minded her having a break or being downstairs. It was the idea of her ironing equipment cluttering up the living room in front of his high-definition pride and joy that bothered him. It made no sense to Georgina, but it wasn't worth rowing about again. She switched the bedroom TV off and turned to the door. And she heard something. Her first shock reaction was that it was Barry. But it couldn't be, not yet, could it? She looked at the alarm clock. No, no. So maybe it was one of those creaky house sounds. But then she heard the sound again, and it was human. A wheeze. Barry might not be as young as he liked to think he was, but he didn't wheeze. Especially not since he'd lost weight and started going to the gym. Still, Georgina doubted herself. How could she be hearing a wheeze? If Barry was here, in the bedroom with her, and she asked him to go downstairs, he'd tell her not to be stupid. Was she being stupid? And then she heard the wheeze again. Who could it be? The house was always unlocked, as they mostly were in Roseville. But no one popped in without calling out a greeting as they came through the door. And no one Georgina knew wheezed. It was a real puzzle. Surely it couldn't be a burglar or anything big city like that. And if it was, what did one do? She picked up the iron. She went toward the bedroom door, but the iron jerked and almost fell out of her hand. Silly Georgina. Had to be unplugged. At the bottom of the stairs, iron in hand, Georgina heard more sounds from her dining room. Or maybe they came from beyond it in her kitchen. Hello, she called. Who's there? Her grip on the iron grew tighter. It was absurd to think she was in danger, not in Roseville. But you never knew. Look at all those murders they covered on those CSIs. Sometimes more than one in a show. She shivered. Hello? She called again. In the doorway between kitchen and dining room, Georgina found an old woman. The old woman wore a brown fabric coat, a little blue hat on her gray head. As Georgina saw the woman saw her. Frederica, the woman said. Who? Georgina said. Frederica, is that you? You look so different. Some foam appeared in the corner of the old woman's mouth. Georgina felt a moment of panic. Frederica, the old woman said again, but this time there was hostility in her voice, anger. What have you done with Connie? She's only 3, you know. And the woman began to move forward, waving the hand that wasn't holding her floppy cloth shoulder bag. What is wrong with her? Georgina thought. And then she realized what the problem must be. But what should she do about it? Oh, God! Oh, God! It was just then that Barry's car pulled into the driveway. The old woman peered at Georgina. You're not Frederica, she said. No, dear, I'm not. So what are you doing in my house? Are you collecting for charity? Because I'll tell you now. And the old woman stopped to catch her breath. I'll tell you now, we always give at the office. With Barry about to come in to help, Georgina felt a wave of confidence and even a protective feeling about this poor old person. Like as not, Barry would call the police or chuck the poor drooling old dear out on the street. How frightening that would be for her. Georgina sympathized. She moved forward to put her sympathetic arm around the old lady. It was then she saw a piece of paper fastened with a safety pin to her coat. It read, If you are reading this, then my wife must have gotten out of the motel room. I'm real sorry she's been a bother. She's no harm, but if you give me a call or drop her at the Sunset Motel on Danforth Street, room 116, I'd be beholden. The note finished with a phone number. What have you done with Frederica? The old woman asked. Barry was not in a good mood. He'd been just fine as he left Maxie's. Maxie treated a man with a bit of respect. But now, to have to make this god-awful stop at the Sunset Motel on his way to see Jim Penny? Who knew what consequences there'd be for his equilibrium, his judgment at the meeting? Never mind that the Sunset was on the very road he drove to Fraserton on. Man had to be on his tippy toes to get the better of Jim Penny. Oh, please, Georgina had said. I'm not sure I can handle something like this by myself. You can just drop her at reception if you don't want to look round for room 116. Barry looked at the gray, lumpy figure on the passenger seat of his nearly new, low-mileage Escape. The old woman was staring straight ahead, as she had done since being loaded into the car. Oh, well, so long as there wasn't a problem getting her out, as long as 116 wasn't empty when he knocked. They came to the motel and Barry pulled in. For the first time, his passenger turned from staring straight ahead. Lipstick, she said. What? The old woman turned back to stare through the windshield. Barry pulled up in front of room 116, no need to ask where it is. He knew the layout of the Sunset. He unhooked the old woman's seatbelt and went around the car to the passenger door. Opening it, the woman was prized out easily. He directed her by a shoulder to the room and knocked, fully prepared to dash away if no one responded. But a moment later, the door opened, and a stout, bald old man said, Gladys, thank God! Oh, thank you, sir, thank you. Barry suddenly felt he'd been needlessly petty. Not at all, he said. It was on my way, pretty much. Wherever did you find her? On Redfield Drive, halfway across town. She was in the house, frightened the life out of my wife. Barely nearly mentioned the drool, but decided not to. The old man's eyes teared. I'm so sorry, he He took Gladys's hand and led her gently into the room. "Frederica," Gladys said, "what's happened to Connie?" "I don't know what I'm going to do," the old man said to Barry. "I just don't know." Barry said, "Maybe get some help?" "But where? From who?" The old man retreated into the room and closed the door. Barry went back to his car and settled himself in the driver's seat. He flipped the mirror down and checked his tie and his hair. And then he checked the side of his neck. There was, indeed, a small spot of Maxie's lipstick. Ollie Kornbach was late for work. He leapt out of his car, pausing only to straighten his tie and jacket. He headed into the sheriff's department. Debbie Fry didn't speak as she passed him going the other way. Stuck-up bitch, Ollie thought. She was such a sore loser. Not his fault if she didn't actually ask him if he was married before she hopped into the sack with him. In fact, he'd probably helped her out in the long run. She'd know in the future not to try to sleep her way to a promotion in the first week of a new job. She'd know next time to wait a while, wait till she knew how the guys in the hierarchy were fixed, till she knew the lay of the land, so to speak. Lay of the land, that was good. Ollie would try to remember to tell it to Lou in the diner mid-shift. Lou, his best friend from Roseville High. He'd gone away for a while, Lou, but now he was back. And maybe when his convictions had expired, Ollie could get him onto the force. Maybe in Debbie's place, if the stuck-up bitch held on to the job here for that long before transferring to pastures new. Ollie strode into the deputy's office. Sorry, Wayne. Last-minute emergency at home. So last minute you forgot to zip up again? Ollie looked down and checked his flies. Gotcha, Wayne said, rising from behind the desk. But I think you just told me more than I want to know about why you were late. Man's got to do, Ollie said with a grin. Well, a man's got to do a lot of paperwork tonight, Wayne said. Yeah, what's happened? Crime wave. Ollie perked up. Was it his chance to crack a big one at last? He had ambitions to work for the state police, but without a degree, he'd be stuck in the slow lane forever unless he could crack a big one. Mrs. Perriton had her jewelry box emptied this morning. Mrs. Who? And the Larovics lost cash and some kind of old Indian artifaction. The who? And John Baker. He came home to find some oldie English figurines gone, and his jade cufflinks missing, and a gold Mexican dish vanished. What's a gold dish, do you know? Ollie was frowning. What's going on? We've had 14 reports of thefts today. But we don't get that many in a month, he considered. In a year, most years. Well, we got it today. I processed 6 reports, but the other 8 are awaiting your personal attention. Hell's bells. Maybe no visit to Lou at the diner tonight after all. While you were out in town today, Wayne asked, you didn't see a gang of bikers or anything, did you? The phone began to ring. That's probably another one, Deputy Chief Kornbach. Wayne slipped his jacket on. Have fun. No, Ollie said about the bikers. He had been out in town, but he hadn't seen a damn thing out of the ordinary. He dropped into the seat at the desk. I didn't see a damn thing. He picked up the phone. Roseville Sheriff's Office. She nearly got caught, Frank said to Beverly. Shut up and drive, Margaret said sharply. But then something caught in her throat, and trying to clear it, she began to wheeze. I'm just saying, Frank said. Well, I had an easy time, Beverly said. She was short and round and wore her graying hair long and straight. "What do you think the pickings will come to today?" Margaret asked, her breathing under control again. "You should have seen her, though, Bev," Frank said with a smile. "When she got returned to the room, she looked great. How do you do that drool, Marg? The guy who brought you in was really spooked." "Natural talent," Margaret said. "You know, I was just thinking..." "There's a first," Frank said. "Just kidding. I was thinking that what we're doing is really a contribution to Homeland Security. All these small town people leave their doors open, their cars running when they go into the drugstore for a lotto ticket. They have no attitude of alertness. What would happen if Al-Qaeda came to Roseville? Security is all about vigilance." "Yeah, right," Bev said. "Justify it however you want, sweetie. But we're making money for ourselves." "That too," Margaret said. "I was just saying..." She coughed and stifled a wheeze. "There was a chance, if it got too bad, Frank and Bev would make her be the one stay in the motel room while he went out, despite the fact that women at the money end were less risky because they were less threatening." "Well," Frank said, "it is my grandson's birthday next month, and you know what greedy little beggars kids are these days because of the TV they watch." The women chimed. "Amen." "So," he said, "where's next? Who's got the map?"
The stories in this podcast are copyrighted by their authors. Music for the podcast was composed and performed by Roger Lewin, son of author Michael Z. Lewin, and is also copyrighted. Sound editing and mixing were done by Emily Giuliarano. You can find more stories like those you've just listened to in Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine. To subscribe, visit our website at www.themysteryplace.com/EQMM.